Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 163, recorded August 11th, 2014. Andy Weir. Triangulation is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting, smartest, most compelling people in technology today. And I am so thrilled. I say this every time, but it's always true. I'm so thrilled to welcome our guest to the show today. You probably heard us during our Audible ads, any downtime, whenever possible, recommend a novel, a science fiction novel called The Martian. The author of The Martian is here today with us. Andy Weir, so great to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
This is your first novel?
The first one that got published, yeah.
Actually, yeah, I saw on Wikipedia you had another one. Should I run to read it?
No, probably not. well, actually, like the first novel I ever wrote, fortunately, I wrote before the days of the internet. And so there are no surviving copies out there in the digital landscape, and no one will ever see it, which is good. It was it's really bad. You know, it's first pancake. The second one, I think, had an okay story and a decent plot line. I may revisit it someday, but the writing is really clumsy and it's out there. If people care enough, you can find it with searches, and other people have archived it. It's called Theft of Pride.
Theft of Pride, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't highly recommend it. If you're going to read a book by me, I suggest The Martian.
Well, we all suggest it. It is one of the best science fiction books, not only of the year, but I've read in many a year. It's really good. It's hard science, which I think a lot of us like. You're a computer programmer by trade.
Yeah, for 25 years I was a computer programmer. I recently quit to go full-time writing.
Yes, a smart move, I believe. tell me about what kind of computer programming. What were you doing?
Well, I did lots of things during the course of my career. I started off, what did I start off doing? My first job was writing like software to analyze data for a national lab. Then later on, I also worked for Nisus software, which made...
Oh, I love Nisus.
There you go.
Yeah, did you write Nisus?
Well, I was one of the many engineers on it, yeah.
Great Mac word processor, which kind of... they came back recently. I don't know what happened to them, but...
Yeah, it's kind of hard to compete with the big names.
Yeah.
This was back in the early 90s when there was still a little bit more competition in that field. And then I went to work for Blizzard, and I worked on Warcraft 2, the game.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow.
And I spent... then I worked for AOL for a long time. So it's engineering. If I describe a 25-year career, I mean... 3 years at one company is a long time as a software engineer. But I bounced around a lot. I did a lot of mobile engineering. And the most recent job was mobile device management, which is, it would be boring to describe. It's a B2B thing.
It's a B2B thing you wouldn't understand.
It is. No, I didn't say you wouldn't understand it.
No, I know. I'm teasing.
You understand it.
You were a comp sci major in college?
Yeah, CSE. Yep.
And yet, it sounds like you always had a hankering to write.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I also had a hankering not to live in an alleyway. I didn't really take a writing career seriously as a career option. I always just did it on the side. Well, you know, that's not true. Okay, so after AOL laid me off, I had a bunch of money, and so I spent 3 years trying to break into writing.
Perfect time to do it. Yeah, you got some runway, yeah.
That's when I wrote Theft of Pride, and I spent 3 years trying to get an agent or a publisher interested, and I just couldn't get any traction. And I said, well, I tried. And so then I went back to engineering and figured, oh, well, writing will be my hobby. But then, you know, in the intervening time, the internet showed up and did its thing, and you now don't have to put out a huge personal outlay to self-publish, and kind of things went from there, so... It's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there are lots of programmers and other professions that have that, you know, novel in the desk drawer next to the next to the bottle of scotch. but you made it work, and I think that's so exciting. It's so cool.
Yeah, and I have no idea what I did right, but
well, you wrote a great book, and it encourages me because even though initially the initial response to The Martian was indifference from agents and publishers, you found an audience. Well,
that's really not true.
It's not true. Okay.
That has gotten around. I think at some point early on, someone conflated the story of me trying to get Theft of Pride published with the story of The Martian. The Martian was always popular right away. So I feel like I got either, you know, really lucky or I.
But you did self-publish it.
Yes, I did. Initially. But I never tried to publish it any other way.
Oh, I see.
So the story of it is that I wrote it initially just as a serial that I was posting on my website. It was my hobby.
Oh.
And then when I finished it, I had I would get these emails from people saying like, hey, I really like The Martian. I'm really enjoying it, but I hate reading it in my web browser. Can you make an EPUB version so I can read it on my e-reader? So I figured out how to do that, and I said, sure, here you go. And then I'd get emails from other people saying like, hey, it's great that you put an EPUB version up. I also put a Mobi version up. But I'm not really technically savvy, and I don't know how to download an EPUB from the internet and get it onto my e-reader. So could you just post it on a Kindle? And so I figured out how to post things to Kindle, and you have to charge a minimum of 99 cents. So I said, like, all right, so here's the free version of my of the EPUB right here on my site, and then here's the pay version on Kindle where you can pay a buck, and basically you're paying a buck to have Amazon deliver it to your Kindle. That's basically what's happening, right? But like more people would buy it from Kindle than would download it for free from my site. So it ended up selling really well on Amazon, and then that got it up into the top sellers lists on Amazon, and that got the attention of publishers and my agent, the guy who would become my agent.
Why didn't you try to sell it? Why did you just give it away?
I didn't take the financial aspects seriously. I didn't think that it would be a real moneymaker. And I was a computer programmer at the time. Money wasn't like I wasn't poor, and I had a good income, so it wasn't a huge priority to me.
Is it incorrect? It says on the Wikipedia page that you sold the rights to the audiobook before you sold the rights to the print book.
Yeah, that's correct. The audiobook, those rights went to Podium Publishing. They were the first people to approach me for any sort of like professional publication. Yeah,
that's the first I've ever heard that happening.
Yeah, I think it might happen more and more because I think more and more people are going to self-publish.
Right.
And the audiobook publishers and print publishers and even movie studios are now looking at the self-publishing world for basically good content. And they don't have to even work that hard to find it. They can just say, like, well, what's selling well? And then why is it selling well? And then would that sell well in the category of products that we make?
It's a kind of a farm system, isn't it? You can.
It is kind of, and it's cool because, as a writer, you don't have to put out any personal risk at all. Well, no money risk. I mean, you had to put the time into writing, but presumably, if you want to be a writer, that's okay with you. You know,
is that the case? You just—it's so much fun for you that you'd. Who was it? Jerry Purnell was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and. I think he quoted Boswell saying that anybody who writes for free is a fool. You disagree.
Well, I definitely do a lot of writing for free. I write short stories and post them to my site, and people can just go read them. There's no ads or anything. I don't know. It is my hobby, but also it's you know, work. It's not always fun. there's a lot of grunt work and grinding involved, and you know,
it's hard.
The job.
Hardest work I've ever done.
Yeah. Well, I like to tell the story, and I think that's what you'll find that writers all have in common. They have a story, and they want an audience. They want to yeah. know that a bunch of people heard/read/saw their story.
Do you like making up stories, telling stories, to you know that kind of thing? I mean, that's something you naturally do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got a big old ideas file full of stories. I don't have enough lifespan left to write all the book ideas I have. So
awesome. I'm very glad to hear that.
well, we'll see. Maybe The Martian's the only good idea I ever had, and the rest just seem good to me. We'll find out. I'm working on my next book now. So
yay! And by the way, there are people in the chat room who, oddly enough, have not read The Martian. Almost everybody who watches Twit has read The Martian, because starting with Brian Brushwood and then through the rest of us as we read it, everybody's said, "You've got to read this." We've virtually grabbed people by the collar and shaken them, saying, "You've got to read this." And actually, many of us have listened to it on Audible, that Podium original Podium recording. It's fantastic.
Yep. Yeah. The narrator, R.C. Bray, did a great job.
He captures your Mark Watney's wry, sardonic point of view very nicely, I think.
If you look around, I saw this YouTube video of it's R.C. Bray, doing prep work for reading The Martian, and it just shows him, like, eating raw potatoes. And
now, stuff like that. We're going to be very careful because we won't give you any spoilers.
We don't want to give away.
Yeah, so, and while...
Vader is Luke's father, by the way.
So the bulk of the book is really not susceptible to spoilers. I think the premise is set up in the very first paragraphs. Actually, the very first.
Yeah.
You start with the F word, which is dramatic.
I do. Yep.
And gets your attention. And it's Mark Watney, who's an astronaut. He is in the third mission, manned mission to Mars. There's been a calamity, a storm hits. The remainder of his team is forced to leave. He has been struck by an antenna, and they think impaled and killed. So they leave without him. Turns out he's not dead yet. And wakes up, and the rest, most of the novel, is, it feels like it would be a graduate student in physics puzzler. You are on the surface of Mars. You have 13 liters of water. You have this. You have that. You have a nuclear reactor. You have various things. How do you survive? And it's not for a month or a year. It's for a couple of years, almost a couple of years he has to survive.
He doesn't have a reactor.
He doesn't.
No. He has a whole bunch of solar panels that he can get electricity from that. And he also has the RTG that comes up later, which is...
Yes. That's kind of like a reactor.
It's pretty significant difference. Like a reactor is a big old thing that takes a whole staff of people to operate, and RTG just
sits
is
there
always
and,
hot
and eats. Now
but that's what it does.
Now
yeah.
We're gonna get in the meat of it, and this is so much fun. Okay. It is really fun. First of all, I think it was on Wikipedia, some reviewers have compared it to something like Apollo 13 meets Castaway, both Tom Hanks.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
I actually go back farther. I say it's Robinson Crusoe on Mars.
Yeah, except there was a movie called Robinson Crusoe on Mars. It's not that.
But it is similar.
Take a little pill to provide you with oxygen, and he had a pet monkey.
Yeah. Yeah, no, not the same.
Different.
No, in fact, one of the things I love about this is now, and this is a question for you, it seems to be, I'm no expert, I'm no aerospace expert, very, very technically accurate. That was your intent?
Oh, yeah. No, I did tons of research, and I wanted it to be as accurate as possible. There are a few places where it's inaccurate, some of them mistakes, one of them just a decision I made to sacrifice accuracy for narrative convenience, I guess.
Really?
But,
you want to tell us where those places are, or would you like us to just...
No, I can tell you. The biggest place where we deviate from real physics is the sandstorm right at the beginning, the thing that caused the crew to evacuate.
Yeah.
In real life, a Martian sandstorm doesn't have has practically no inertia at all.
Yeah.
The winds can get up to 150 kilometers an hour, but the atmosphere is less than 1% the density of Earth's. So that's kind of the overall inertia is like the equivalent of being hit with a 2-kilometer-an-hour wind.
It
doesn't matter. It wouldn't hurt equipment. It wouldn't hurt anybody.
That does. It is an important plot point later on, in fact.
There's
that he could be in a sandstorm and maybe
not even know it.
Not even know
yeah.
it.
That's a more realistic one, the one yeah. later on in the book. Now, I knew at the time that I wrote it that it was not a, that the initial sandstorm was not a realistic depiction of a Martian sandstorm, but it's like so out there in the public belief
right.
that that sandstorms on Mars are like these, you know, right. horrendous maelstroms. And I just decided to take advantage of that. I had another way where it could have happened, where the whole setup could have happened due to a malfunction while they were testing an engine on the MAV. But it seemed cooler to have nature be the prime mover in a man versus nature story.
Interesting. Interesting. So that was a conscious decision.
Yeah, that was a conscious decision. There are a few mistakes here and there in the novel that were just mistakes.
Did you go out?
They're so minor.
What was the process? Did you do a lot of research, write, and then bring it to aerospace scientists and say, is this accurate? How did you do this?
Well, yeah, except for that third part where I checked it.
You just did the best you could.
I just did the best I could. I didn't know any aerospace scientists or anything before The Martian. I had no connection with that. With that whole world. I do now.
Well, you must feel pretty good then that there's only a few minor inaccuracies.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about overall how well the story has stood up.
I love it because there's so many things to like about it. First of all, who doesn't love science fiction? Everybody who watches our shows loves science fiction. But mostly we like hard science fiction, not fantasy, not rainbow ponies riding through space, but or monkeys and air pills, but real as scientifically accurate as possible, and you really feel like he is in a situation where there's these very real constraints, and he's got very limited resources, and somehow he has to survive. What is it? 400 sols, 400 Martian days, something like that.
Longer.
And there's not enough food. There's not enough water. I mean, there's real issues that he has to solve. And he comes up, first of all, Mark Watney is a hero, much in the Jason Bourne style, where this guy is just brilliant. He's the low man on the totem pole on the mission. He says, the only way I get to command this mission is if everybody else is dead. Guess what? I'm in command. And so he's a botanist. But somehow he's also really smart. And by the end of the book, not only do you trust him, but NASA is kind of blown away by – oh, I shouldn't say that. We don't know.
Oh, well, that's okay.
We don't know who's blown
that's
away.
That's all right.
There is see, now I found a spoiler, and I shouldn't have brought that up.
It's not the end of the world. So the thing is, like I wanted him to come off as sort of the everyman, like he's,
yes.
you know, he's like your barber got stranded on Mars.
Well, that's the second side of it, is that he's funny, he's sardonic, he's witty. He's fundamentally good-natured, which is great.
Right, and I didn't want the book to degenerate into this, you know, a man's, like, constant struggle against loneliness and depression as he, you know, tries to extend his life or anything like that. I wanted to be a little bit more upbeat. So I didn't really cover the very real problems of, like, crippling loneliness you'd have if you were in his
right.
situation.
Right.
As for the competence and being really good at stuff, well, the idea is that, you know, he was chosen for a Mars mission. He must
yeah.
be pretty bright.
Yeah.
They don't just pull people in off the street. Yeah. So,
I have to say, I was a little worried when I started reading it that that's exactly what it was going to be. It was, oh, my God, this is going to get grim. We've got
yeah.
500-plus days. We've got to go through this. This guy, it's going to be depressed. And you immediately lift him up with his sense of humor, his railing against disco. you just love the guy very quickly. And that's also important because you've got to be rooting for him.
Yeah, you need to root for the protagonist in any book.
Yeah.
The quickest way to drive off a reader is for them to either not care about or actively dislike the protagonist.
Yeah, well, in this case, you love Mark Watney. Now, the good news is he is like Jason Bourne. Matt Damon's going to be playing him. Ridley Scott directing. The movie will be out late next year. That must be exciting for you.
Yeah. I mean, fingers crossed that they greenlight it. But
Still haven't greenlighted it? Lit it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you never really know until they actually start shooting.
Right.
But all indications are good. They seem to be, people seem to be, you know, committing to playing the roles, and they're looking at locations, and they've announced a release date, which I assume is a good sign.
That's a very good sign. They got to start shooting soon, in fact, if they're going to make it. And did Matt Damon contact you and ask you questions about it?
Oh, no. I'm very much out of the loop. My only job on the film is to cash the check.
Oh, you're not going to go there like George R. R. Martin does and sit on in a special chair and watch the whole thing go?
No. I'm not. I don't have that kind of gravitas.
Would you like to?
You know, it'd be pretty cool to watch a day of shooting, but I don't know anything about the film industry and or how to make good movies, so my opinions really should be ignored.
Okay, we gotta talk here. This is the completely wrong attitude going in. You have to say, no, I must protect my artistic vision. Of course, you got Ridley Scott. That's not going to be too far off.
I feel okay with, you know, Ridley Scott.
Wow.
He probably knows a little bit more about making movies than I do. So,
well, and he's done quite a few great science fiction movies. He knows how to make an astronaut. And boy, this is we all want to see it. But the good news is this is such a visual book that you will be seeing the movie, especially if you listen to the audiobook. You'll really see the movie as it unfolds. And you really do start rooting for Mark Watney, the astronaut, in a big way. You just want him. and of course, bad things have to happen.
Yeah,
can't just be easy sailing.
Tough times.
Yeah. How did you balance that? I mean, you don't want too many bad things to happen.
Well, yeah. So basically the book's all about problem solving, right? He encounters a problem, he solves it. I wanted the problems to be plausible and reasonable for the scenario he's in. It's not just that he keeps getting struck by lightning in various unlucky ways, right?
Right.
Although, so
Some bad breaks.
He does have some bad breaks, but I generally wanted each problem to be caused by kind of his solution to the last problem.
Mm.
Like, oh, this went wrong, so here's what I did to fix it. Okay, well, now because I did that, now I have this other problem.
Yeah.
Or he has a number of problems right from the start that he tries to fix, set about remedying, I guess, without giving too many spoilers. And, you know, he just keeps running into new new issues.
It's like a programmer. I think this is a little informed by your profession.
Could be.
Yeah. Programming is the process of, first of all, figuring out what the problem is and then solving it. And then often the solution creates new problems.
Well,
right?
Yeah. Yep.
I think this is somewhat informed by that.
It could be. Could be. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah.
Yeah.
Could be.
Now, you didn't have a background in interplanetary travel and aerospace at all?
No, it's a hobby. I mean, I've always been very, very interested in the space program, everybody's space programs, you know, Europe, China, Japan, everybody, and manned and unmanned. I don't know why, but I have an interest in like orbital dynamics. I've always thought it was really cool, you know, things moving around, you know.
No spoilers, but there is involved a very intriguing maneuver in orbital dynamics, which the nice thing about this, the best science fiction stands on the shoulders of previous science fiction. Admittedly, there's not one universe in any, you know, in science fiction, but there is a certain kind of continuity. And so this particular orbital maneuver we've heard of before. We might have seen it before. And so it resonates. You go, oh, yeah, they could do that.
I think I know what you're referring to, but I'm not sure. but yes, there's a lot.
I'm talking about slingshotting.
Slingshotting. Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
It's not science fiction.
You didn't make that up.
I did not make that up.
Yeah.
And that has been done by many things in the real world.
Right.
But actually, like I worked out all the orbital paths that the ship takes.
Yeah.
Like they're accurate. And the times and transition times and everything between them are all accurate.
Mars is a very popular subject for science fiction authors, obviously. It's our nearest planet. It's the most likely planet that we will visit first.
Well, it's the most convenient. Venus is closer, but Venus is awful.
Venus is just no fun. Didn't realize. So Venus is more distant from the sun, but it's closer to us in orbit.
Venus is closer to the sun than we are.
Closer to the sun.
But it's closer to us than Mars is.
Oh, I always thought of Mars as being the closest planet.
No, Mars is the fourth planet. Venus is the second.
Right.
And
we're the third.
We're the third. The problem with a number of problems with Venus. First off, it actually takes, I could be wrong on this, but I think I'm not. It takes more delta V to get to Venus than it does to get to Mars. So you have to change your velocity more to get to Venus than to Mars, which is why humanity has only sent a few probes to Venus and we've sent a whole bunch to Mars.
Right.
And second off, there is absolutely no hope of a manned landing on Venus. And we would need technology that we can't even imagine right now. Venus's atmosphere on the surface is 90 times thicker than Earth's. So it's the equivalent of being 900 meters underwater. Like that amount of pressure is what's happening on the surface. So, I mean, we can't even make a submarine that – maybe we can. Yeah, we can make submarines that can do that. 90 atmospheres? 10 meters is an atmosphere.
Yeah, but you don't want to send a submarine to Venus. That's no good at all.
So it's much easier to have a manned mission on Mars. So that's why we're more interested in it.
Well, I think I've read Ben Bova's Mars, which is a wonderful book. Kim Stanley Robinson did a trilogy – describing how men and women might come to Mars, colonize it, and what the outshot. So this is fertile territory for sci-fi.
And I loved Ben Bova's Mars, by the
loved
way.
That was
like one of
great
my favorite.
Book. Me too.
Yeah.
But The Martian is my new favorite Mars book.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I'm not alone. There have been some pretty interesting, the internet seems to have reacted quite well. Tom Horn, for instance, who is an Australian developer, has done a map of Andy Weir's The Martian and of Mark Watney's travels. I love this because the first thing you see when you go to the map is, have you read The Martian yet? And if you say no, it takes you to Amazon. And it's okay, read this.
Yep. Because the map has spoilers, of course.
Yeah, so. Yeah,
that was cool.
Really cool. You must be gratified by that, too. That shows that you've touched a nerve, right?
Yeah, it's great. I'm loving the response I'm getting. It's a dream come true. I never imagined it would get this popular. It's awesome.
Yeah. We're going to talk some more, but we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Andy Weir. He's the author of The Martian, which is a fabulous new sci-fi book. Came out in audio. It's available at audible.com. That's where I listen to it. It's also in print on Amazon and other, bookstores everywhere. And, yes, Ridley Scott, apparently, is going to be directing Matt Damon in a motion picture version, which will have come out late next year. So I think this is well and truly a hit. We'll talk some more about Mars, and I'll take your questions too in the chat room. Those of you watching live, and in the chat room, we'll get some questions for Andy Weir as we continue triangulation. But first, a word from our friends at Prosper. This is Silicon Valley's answer to the big bank loan. You know, the idea of walking into a bank, hat in hand, with your neckties out. I'd like a little money to, you know, pay off your credit cards, or maybe to take some time and write a novel. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending service where they bring together people with money to lend with people who need money to borrow. And it works really well, so well now that there are 2 million Prosper members, lenders and borrowers alike. They've funded over $1 billion in loans, all without a bank, without going into a bank. I think for legal reasons, there's kind of some bank that signs the papers or whatever, but you don't have to deal with it. In fact, if you go right now to prosper.com/twit, you can find out what your rate will be. Just give them a few simple details, and they'll give you an online quote without affecting your credit score, and you could get up to $35,000 in 72 hours. You know, I've got a great American novel in mind. I'm going to call it The Venusian, and if I had a little money, I could work on this thing. Prosper offers low fixed rates. These are unsecured personal loans, so you don't have to provide collateral. And yes, of course, there are multi-year terms available. Prosper.com/twit. This is a revolution in lending, and such a great idea. And for a limited time, Prosper's offering our viewers a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. So go to prosper.com/twit. That's a special site for Twit viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card waiting for you at prosper.com twit. We're talking with Andy Weir, who is the geek idol of the moment because he wrote The Martian, which is the book everybody's talking about. Great word of mouth. The story is about Mark Watney, a member of the third man's mission to Mars, who gets stranded, left behind, and has to survive 500 Martian days, 500 sols, with what he has at hand. And, of course, I've said this would be a great class for the graduate physics student. You're stranded on Mars. You have this, this, and this. What do you do? Did it feel like that for you when you were solving these problems?
I did have a lot of fun with the problem solving because I would come up with the problems first and then I'd say like, okay, well now I got to put some thought into how we'd solve it. Of course, being the writer, I can cheat. I could just say like, oh, in order to solve this, he'd need this other piece of technology. And so I can go back four chapters and mention, oh yeah, and I have one of these doohickeys.
Well, like the RTG, is that something that is normally on would be on a manned mission to Mars?
They would usually not like to put RTGs and humans together. So they do use RTGs a lot all the time. There's one in the current big rover running around Mars right now, Curiosity, also known as Mars Science Laboratory. It is powered by an RTG.
Oh.
But
so it's not unheard of. I mean, this is an actual thing NASA uses. Well,
this is a real technology. Yeah. But they don't like to have it near people because it literally is a material so radioactive that it's just hot all the time. Like it's literally so radioactive that it's just constantly generating heat, and then they make electricity from that heat.
It's so RTG stands for radioisotope thermoelectric generator.
Yes, and they have put them on manned missions in the past. Apollo 13, interestingly, had an RTG aboard as part of the equipment that they were going to leave on the moon. And it ended up going into the one of our oceans because the lunar module came back to Earth on the case of Apollo 13 because it was a lifeboat.
Right.
Yeah. And so that RTG is somewhere at the bottom of the ocean. Long story short, RTGs, NASA would rather they didn't have much to do with astronauts. That's why in the context of this story, it was there to power the MAV when no one was in it. And then as soon as the crew arrived, they were expected to take the RTG far away and leave it there.
Bury it. The MAV is what?
Oh, the Mars Ascent Vehicle. That's the ship that that they take to get back up to their main ship. So they have a big ship that they took to get from Earth to Mars, and it goes into orbit around Mars. Then they have a little ship called the MDV, Mars Descent Vehicle, that lands on Mars from that detaches from the big ship and then lands on Mars, kind of like the lunar lander did. And the MDV's only purpose in life is to get them safely to the surface. And then they will take the MAV, Mars Ascent Vehicle, which is a different ship, to get back to their main ship when the mission's over. The MAV was landed there remotely in advance. So it was there before they even got to Mars. And it spent a bunch of time making fuel out of Mars's atmosphere, which is a thing you can do.
And they build a midway point on Hermes. And is this how an actual Mars mission might play out? Did you go and research NASA documents?
There are a lot of ideas on how a manned Mars mission could work. This one is known as Mars Direct, and it was invented in large part by Robert Zubrin. And I deviated from Mars Direct. I put my own changes to it because I think Mars Direct was invented before we really had ion engines. And I won't go into all the technical details, but Mars Direct is a little bit different than what's described in the novel, but it's close enough.
It's kind of interesting. Lately, last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of talk about this crazy perpetual motion machine that scientists have invented that bounces around microwaves inside a container and then somehow magically develops thrust.
Yeah, it's not perpetual motion. It's propellantless propellantless propulsion.
I understand. It's in the same category. As far as I'm concerned, NASA seems to think maybe there's some promise there. They're researching it anyway.
Yeah, they're speculating on what it could be pushing against.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is interesting.
Yeah.
It could be based on it could be pushing on this effect that happens that also causes Hawking radiation on black holes. So it could be the same effect, which is that matter just kind of like the theory is that matter just kind of pops into the universe and then destroys itself. Just little pieces like a proton and an antiproton will just show up and then destroy themselves. And they'll just exist in the universe for a very, very short period of time, like 10 to the minus 31st seconds or something. And they're theorizing that this propulsion system might be pushing off of that matter while it's present.
Yeah.
That's just one of the theories.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
It's interesting. I am a follower of John Baez, who's a physicist and professor at the University of California, Riverside, who says it's nuts. But anyway, it may be nuts. And you know what? Maybe it's real and we just don't understand the mechanism. However, one of the things that they're interested in it for is a very similar kind of mission to Mars that you describe, where it's a very small amount of thrust, but it's continuous. So this craft continues to accelerate over a long period of time.
If this turns out to be real, I mean, you know, and I would love for it to be real, but I'm kind of with your friend. I suspect they're going to find it some sort of like instrumentation problem, the experiment itself. But, you know, while we can dream about it, if it turned out to be real, that would change the nature of deep space exploration, because now, I mean, it would mean all we need now is energy density, and that's it.
You put a nuclear reactor in a spacecraft. It generates the microwaves with thousands of watts of energy. And then, but there's no, because there's no propellant.
You don't need to carry all that propellant mass
up. It shoots you along.
It just moves.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why cars and boats don't need rocket engines, because you push against the road or the water.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And so this is pushing against something
magic.
I think it'll probably be disproven, but man, it'd be cool if it didn't have to.
Yeah. So the ionic engine that they use in The Martian is a propellant engine, but it's a similar idea of a very small amount of thrust.
Yeah, it's called a very high specific impulse is what it means. It means how much thrust do you get for a certain amount of mass that you throw out the back of the ship, and ion engines have the very best of it.
Right. And so that's absolutely one of the candidates for how this would all happen. It takes them, what, 179 days to get to Mars, something like that?
I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
It's in the book, and I have it in my notes, but yeah.
How about the chat room's asking about the caloric calculations you made, which are wonderful. one of the biggest problems that Mark Watney faces is he's got to be there for 500 sols. He's got food for maybe 150 or something like that. He's got to figure out how to survive.
Yeah, he had about 300 sols worth of food left.
Okay.
And and that's not long enough for him to survive. I don't want to give away too much about the book, but 300 sols is not enough time.
Right.
And so he has to come up with a solution to that, which comes early enough in the book. It's not a big spoiler.
It's not a huge spoiler.
He starts growing potatoes in the hap.
And there are additional problems, because Mars soil is sterile. That's not good for growing. It needs a lot of water. Turns out he has a lot of water, because he recycles everything.
There's a significant plot line in there about him getting more water.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, just remembering the consequences of this as well. It's just great. It's just great. He has to solve all these. So how did you do the caloric stuff? I mean, there's a lot of behind the scenes math, you know, in fact, now that you tell me this was originally serialized, the structure makes a lot more sense, because there definitely is this feeling of now what?
Right. Right.
Cliffhangers.
Yeah. Somewhat episodic. Yeah.
Yeah.
As for the caloric math, well, that's just math. It's just, well, how many calories does a human
need?
Did you
do it? You had to do all of it, though.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I had to do all that. And then the amount of calories in a potato, and what the crop yields are of potatoes when you grow them, and all that stuff.
Are you getting up and going to the library a lot? I guess nowadays,
that's what the internet's
that's
for.
The internet,
But yeah, lots and lots of research. And that's one of the reasons I made him a botanist, was for that scene right there, because it's this is his absolute area of expertise is this sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
And so it,
yeah.
it's not implausible that he would know how to do this. He's a botanist.
That's so great. It speaks to, I guess, some fundamental drive in geeks, in probably most humans, but in geeks certainly, to be presented with a problem and then with intellectual effort solve the problem. And every programmer has this experience. There's this great moment of satisfaction, this ah that occurs
when
I got it. And it's a great feeling. And then every ah is often, not every, but most ahs are often followed by, oh, crap.
Yeah.
And this is the story of The Martian.
Yep,
so great. And you get to have those ahs, as Mark Watney has them. You get to have them. So it's, I think that's part of the mechanism why this is such a pleasurable book to read.
That's the hope. And yeah. some I've had a lot of readers tell me, oh, what I'd like to do is once the problem was defined, I'd put down the book and I'd try to figure out, okay, how would I solve it, and then read on.
See, that's why I think this would be a great course for a graduate. It'd be graduate level physics, because these are problems and you go home tonight and solve that problem. Now we're going to give you another one. Oh, there's a consequence and this is the consequence. Now what do you do? It's just fun. I mean, it really is fun. I was a little worried that it'd be a little hermetic because you've got one character and he's stuck in air chamber in Mars, but you managed to bring in NASA as well. And that makes it fun.
Right. Yeah. Not to give too much away, but,
Well, imagine.
He's not the only character in the book.
Yeah, imagine. Eventually, somebody's got to realize there's something going on up there. They're still looking at it. And so that's part of the fun, too. It's really, I cannot sing its praises highly enough. And I have to say, even as you're reading, and you don't normally want this in a book to think about the author, but it inevitably comes up that you think, wow, this Andy guy did a lot of research, did a lot of work. This feels right.
Oh, well, good. I like the this feels right part, but like you said, I don't want him thinking about the author.
No, I understand, yeah. Maybe that's just me, but I cannot imagine. Now, you wrote an article for Salon about this. It's sort of about this, say science made you a writer, not being a writer made you a scientist.
Well, what the main point was that science caused science affected with an E the plot. In other words, science, like when I would sit down and do all the math on something, I would realize, he's going to have another serious problem.
Yeah.
And so that would create plot. It was awesome. Like the whole water plot line where he had to make more water was because I sat down and did the math on, how much water would you need to grow this much potatoes? And you have to keep the soil a certain minimum level of wet. And it's a closed system, right? So the water's not going anywhere, but you need a certain amount to keep the soil the right moistureness. But
it amazes
what is the
me.
Word I'm looking for here?
Moistureness.
Moistureness. The right wetness.
Wetness.
Anyway, and so I did all the math on that and said, he doesn't have even remotely enough water.
Right.
And so I was like, oh, thank you, science, for telling me the next problem he's going to have.
Yeah.
I didn't even have to come up with it.
Yeah. I'm amazed that you didn't go out and consult experts, that you didn't write this whole thing and then say, all right, let me check.
I didn't know any.
That's great.
I know a number of scientists, physicists and chemists and stuff. And I did run some of that by them, but I didn't know any aerospace people at all.
And because you're writing it, an episode in serial, did you know at the beginning where you were going to go with it? How much of it had you plotted out?
I had the general idea, the main skeleton of the plot that you see in the book. I had that in mind from the beginning, but all the details of how to get from point A to point B, I just kind of made it up as I went along.
That's a high wire act.
A little bit, but I mean, you can go back. I did have things where I'm like, ooh, here's a cool problem he could have. I could have this happen and this happen, and I write it all up, and I get about half a chapter, and I'm like, this will kill him, and there's no way around it. So let's have him not run into that. So there, it wasn't just like I sat down and wrote it all out. There was a lot of, editing and back and forth and...
We should point out that Andy was first hired at the which lab was it? Sandia at a national lab?
Sandia National Sandia. Labs, yeah. Evermore. I worked there.
How old?
I was 15.
15.
When I started there, yeah.
Okay. So obviously a little intelligent.
Maybe.
And you say in this Salon article, I am a nerd.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, an all-around nerd. What other nerdy passions do you have?
Well, probably my... I have a deep and profound love of Doctor Who. Like I love that show.
There's an example of the opposite kind of science fiction where there's no science at all. It makes no sense.
They're not too heavy on the hard sci-fi there.
No.
But it's funny. Is at the Random House Authors Party, I ran into Peter Kleins, who wrote the X-Heroes series.
Oh, that must have been fun for you.
Yeah, and that was cool. And he and I really hit it off, and he's like the only other person I've met who has the same fanatical devotion to Doctor Who that I do. So we kind of sat at a table talking about Doctor Who with each other, and everybody else like just gave up trying to talk to us.
Oh my God, they're still talking about Doctor Who. Oh my God.
Yeah, so definitely I like that. Also, my interests are I like just kind of doing math and physics. So... like I've had this one thing run around my head, and I guess a lot of people are working on it. I wish I could find a way to make relativity make sense.
Yeah.
Like, okay, how do you look at this such that it makes sense? What is an analog or a scenario or some way to look at it?
That's a good one of those things I work on. And if you solve that, I hope you write a novel.
Well, yeah, maybe.
I think if you were around here, you'd find some like-minded Doctor Who fans. There's a few fanatics around this.
I got my picture taken with Matt Smith at Comic-Con. Very excited, yeah.
Who is your favorite Doctor Who?
Well, my favorite's got to be Peter Davison, the fifth Doctor. Mm-hmm. Basically, anybody you ask that question to is going to answer, the Doctor that they started on.
Yeah.
And he was the Doctor when I first started watching back in the 80s.
Yeah, that makes sense. You're like baby ducks. You get imprinted.
Yeah, basically, he's my doctor.
Actually, I've loved him as an actor. He's been in a lot of.
Oh yeah, he was
British
a big name actor
TV
even
shows.
At the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Even he had already finished All Creatures Great and Small,
which was one of my favorite
Tristan
shows
Barthes.
Ever. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yep.
So he was also the cutest Doctor Who, I think.
I don't know. Some of the newer ones are pretty David Tennant. I think a lot of people.
Yeah, good looking guy.
Very good looking guy. Yeah.
Are you a horticulturist? Are you growing potatoes in your back 40?
I can't. I can't grow anything. I'm not in any way like Watney when it comes to that.
I love it. And where did you start in your research? What exactly did you pick up NASA books or Ben Bova's book, or where did you start this process?
In my research?
Yeah.
Just tons and tons of web searches, really.
Yeah.
I already had a pretty solid foundation in basic knowledge about, space travel and orbital dynamics because it's been my hobby. And then for the specific things, I would just look them up as I needed them.
That's amazing. Actually, you that in some ways is a tribute to the internet. I mean, all through this, the tribute to the internet that you were able to distribute yourself, build a fan base by yourself, and sell it for 99 cents or nothing. But also that this would have, imagined if you'd had to go to a library, it would have taken you 10 years to write this book.
Yep. Or I would have just made more stuff up.
Right. So when you put it out, you felt fairly confident, I'm sure, on the technical merits of it. Were you a little maybe nervous that you might have made some horrific accident?
Accident? Like
error?
In the technical stuff?
Yeah.
I wasn't that worried about it. I was just posting it online. And, I figured my readers would tell me if I screwed something up and I'd fix it. It's almost
in fact,
like
you did, didn't you?
Beta, you got beta a couple, readers.
You did have beta readers, and you did fix a couple of things, didn't you?
Yeah, there were a few mistakes here and there that the readers caught and told me about, and I fixed. And then there's still a couple that made it all the way through that nobody noticed until the book came out.
When Chris Hadfield says this, I couldn't put this book down. A very rare combination of good original story, interestingly real characters, and fascinating technical accuracy. I mean, this is the commander of the International Space Station.
Yeah, Commander Hadfield.
Yeah, that's not so bad.
That's pretty cool. Yep.
An actual astronaut says, no, this is pretty accurate. He says it reads like MacGyver meets Mysterious Island. Yet another analogy. There is a lot of MacGyvering in this.
There's a lot. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And there's a lot of 70s TV as well.
Yep. Our for the people who haven't read it yet, our hero has basically a big old data drive full of like 70s music and 70s television that he can watch to keep himself busy.
That's the only thing he can
and
do.
And he doesn't enjoy it. It wasn't his. It was the commander's, the mission commander's like hobby.
Larry Niven, who we just had on recently.
I was pretty excited when he gave a quote. I was like, wow. I called my dad up in the morning. Yeah. I mean, like.
Yeah. I mean, the author Ringworld, a guy also, you know, the hard science sci-fi guy. Mm. He says it shapes up like Robinson Crusoe is written by someone brighter. That's a good line.
Yeah. I'm going to steer clear of insulting Defoe.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the compliment.
Only Larry Niven gets to insult William Defoe.
Yes.
Not William Defoe. Daniel Defoe. William Defoe, anybody can insult him. Anyway, everybody should read it or do as I do and did and listen to it. It's a great audiobook. Have you met R.C. Bray?
I have not. We've spoken over email a few times and like that, but we did not meet in person.
Everybody who listens to the book now thinks of him as Mark, you know, has Mark Watney's head in there, a voice in their head. So.
Yeah, no, he's got a very distinctive voice.
Yeah.
He's a great narrator.
He does the sarcasm nice, right? You got to be happy with how he does that. In fact,
absolutely.
I didn't see the text until later, and so I was really impressed about how he knew. I mean, he delivers your punchlines very well. The timing is excellent.
Great job.
You wouldn't think in a book like this that you'd be laughing out loud. It's not a comedy exactly, but... You do laugh. There are moments where you burst out laughing.
That's the hope.
Yeah, because Watney's such a great character. I look forward to your next novel. Is it also sci-fi?
It's sci-fi. It's not as rigidly realistic as The Martian. It's a little softer. But sci-fi for sure.
Do you ever contemplate maybe a sequel, like what happens when Watney gets home, that kind of thing?
I don't really see a plot there. I mean, if I have some aha moment and I come up with something, then sure, I'd be happy to write a sequel. But it's not plausible. I don't know. There's not much I can say without giving spoilers.
It ends fairly. I tell you, you're maybe this is a testament to how much you like Mark Watney and how much you want the book to go on. But it ends, and it's like, oh, I could have gone on. I mean, you could have done another 100 pages. I wouldn't have complained.
Yeah, you want to be careful of not having that, not having it drag on. It's like, okay, the climax is come and gone. The story's over. You know,
I'll tell you a little.
Exit through the side exits, you know.
Here's the national anthem. Get out of here.
I'll
tell you a little story that I hope you'll appreciate. But one of our hosts, Brian Brushwood, who's a magician and a wonderful talent, he's the one who told us about The Martian, and when he recommends a novel, and he recommends so highly, everybody around here listens, and I read it immediately. But his wife read it later after him, Bonnie, and she was lying in bed listening to the conclusion, the exciting conclusion of this book, and he said, "Oh," and he knew exactly where she was, and he lay down next to her, and they held hands, and they listened to it together.
Aww, that's sweet.
Isn't that romantic?
That's nice.
Andy, I thank you so much for taking the time to join us, and I especially thank you for writing one of the great novels of the last few years, and just a stunner, a great science fiction novel, which everybody must read, The Martian. We look for. I think with Ridley Scott and Matt Damon, it'll be okay. I dread it. I always dread it when I see science fiction on the screen because it's so much better when you listen to the book and it's in your head, but we'll see. I'll give that's a pretty good all-star team working on it.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited by it.
And I look for... When do you think the next novel will be out?
Oh, it wouldn't be out until late next year or early the following one.
Okay. So you're in the middle of it right now.
Yeah, I'm writing it now. Yeah.
And is it as much fun now that you're big and rich and famous?
My life or your...
No, just writing, right?
Oh, yeah. No, it's great. Now that I've quit my day job, I can dedicate all my time to it. It's great.
I should mention the guy who's adapting it for the movies, Drew Goddard is great. He did Buffy.
He's awesome.
Writer of Buffy. He did. He wrote for Alias and Lost. He did Cloverfield.
He directed Cabin in the Woods.
And Cabin in the Woods, which is hysteric, is wonderful, yeah. which I really thought I was going to hate. I adored.
Yeah.
So I think this guy is a good guy to write this. I think he has the right touch.
I've read the screenplay.
You have?
Yeah. They sent me the screenplay for comments. Drew's very he talks to me a lot about you know the screenplay when he was writing it and stuff.
Neat.
And so it's pretty cool. And I did get to meet him, so that was cool. I got to go down.
Yeah, I mean he's one of the best writers out there for this.
Well, yeah, he's awesome. And I'm really happy with the screenplay too.
Are you? Okay, that's the question.
I think everybody really likes the screenplay. That's what's attracting people like Ridley Scott and Matt Damon. That Drew Goddard did a great job on the screenplay. So.
You know, if it hadn't been for the success of Gravity, I think people might have been more reluctant.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right.
But Gravity really succeeded, and you kind of got a sense that you could have a single astronaut be the hero of the story and drive the plot forward. And I think that probably made people think, oh, okay, yeah, this could work.
Or maybe they just looked at the box office results. Of that. Maybe that's something
we want. Mark Watney should be played by Sandra Bullock. Just a thought. It's kind of different, but you know, just something to keep
in mind. It's a little bit different. We could just call it Gravity 2.
Yeah. How about Gravities?
Gravities. And then Gravity Cube. Right. No. That's one thing. It does kind of bug me when people are like, oh, this seems like kind of a ripoff of Gravity. I'm like, it came out first.
Oh, yeah. No, it's not. And by the way, much better. I loved Gravity. Much better.
I loved Gravity too.
Yeah. No, this is the real deal. You got to read this. Thank you, Andy. Great to talk to you. Congratulations on a brilliant novel.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Take care. We do Triangulation every Monday about 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. It's always fun because we get such interesting people like Andy. I hope you'll tune in for it. If you can't, though, on-demand audio and video, as always with all our shows, is always available at our website, twit.tv/TRI. Or, you know, if you subscribe to any of our Twit shows on iTunes, you can get it there. Stitcher on your mobile device. We have Twit apps on iOS, thanks to our great third-party developers. We didn't write them. But they did a great job on iOS, Android, and Windows Phone, on Roku, many devices, so you can always watch that way as well. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Wait a minute. John has a question for you.
No,
another big Martian fan.
I enjoyed the book. Hi, Andy. My name's John. I enjoyed the book tremendously, and I just have to say the line... Rich Purnell is a steely-eyed missile man. Will be to no end.
No, what? Okay, I love the line, but is that a reference to something?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
The Apollo, or even earlier than
steely-eyed.
That. Steely-eyed.
It's a NASA saying.
Steely-eyed
missile
saying.
Man. It's
great.
Like the highest compliment. Thanks.
And that like part, that actual part where they're trying to figure out what the heck's going on was just so good.
Oh, that's
Thank
so,
you so
funny.
Much.
I didn't recognize the reference there. That's great.
Yeah, it's subtle. It's an internal NASA thing. They that's like the highest compliment that you can receive from people at NASA is to call you a steely-eyed missile man.
And if you Google it, you'll find John Aaron, a NASA engineer and flight controller during Apollo.
Apollo 12?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He saved Apollo 12 when it was struck by lightning.
Switch ACE to AUX.
Yeah.
Or something like SEC, such SEC to AUX or something like that. Apollo 12 got struck by lightning twice. All their controls went out and nobody knew what to do. And he said, switch SEC to AUX. And that the three astronauts aboard, two of them had no idea what that meant.
What are you talking about?
And the third one, Alan Bean's like, oh, okay, no, I know what that is.
Pete Conrad said, what the hell is that? Alan Bean was familiar with the location of the SCE, the signal conditioning SCE. Electronics.
Yeah.
Switch inside the capsule, flipped it to AUX, telemetry immediately restored, the mission continued. And he was then declared a steely-eyed missile man.
Yeah, John Aaron, yeah.
Wow. Thank you, John, for letting us know about that. That's great. I remember the line. I didn't understand the reference. I thought it was more like 50s sci-fi. Anyway. Hey, great. And, of course, NASA probably was playing off 50s sci-fi when they said that. Thank you, Andy.